Here you are. BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy. And your plants do too.
Aw,
I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com. And live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, the Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A 19-year-old accused of killing his parents is diagnosed with an unusual psychiatric disorder and spends a torturous 6 years in the Colorado judicial and mental health systems before his case experiences an unexpected end. Just in the Nick of Time is one of the most profound cases of multiple personality disorder, MPD, all told from the perspective of the person who interacted most with the personalities, his criminal defense lawyer, David Savitz. It is a book about what happens when a mental disease far outpaces the understanding of the courts, the psychiatric community, and the public. The book that we're featuring this evening is Just in the Nick of Time, with my special guest, author and attorney, David B. Savitz. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, David B. Savitz.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
Thank you very much, and congratulations on this extraordinary book. It's very unique, and congratulations on bringing this story to the public.
Thank you, and thank you for allowing me to share it with your public.
Let's get right to this extraordinary story. You take us to September 23rd, 1983, and you write that you get a call from your mentor, longtime mentor, and lawyer extraordinaire, Walter Garash. Tell us about this phone call, what he had to say to you.
I believe it was a Friday night, Dan, and I was home. My experience with Walter by then, a span of about 11, 12 years in which we tried cases together. He was a mentor and teacher of mine during that time and throughout the time we practiced together. So I receive a phone call from him, and he says, David, I need you to get money from the estate of Rod and Marilyn Carlson, who were found murdered about a month or so ago, and their son, Ross, is the individual suspected of having committed their murders. He's been arrested. The parents left a will, which included a trust funded by assets, including life insurance, left by them. Ross wants to hire me, David, but I can't get on the case unless we can get the money from that trust. So I need you to go into the probate court in Denver and argue the entitlement and discretion of the trustee to take money from that trust and pay me to defend Ross in his case. And if you succeed, David, then I'll get you on the case as well. So with that carrot, Dan, and with the challenge ahead of me, I learned about the case, filed a motion in the probate court to have the probate court order the trustee to make the distribution from the trust. And that was the beginning of the relationship between me, Walter, and Ross.
You write that there was some trepidation in terms of the grandparents' response and potentially their refusal to be able to give up those funds for Ross to be defended by attorneys.
I think it wasn't so much of their refusal, but I think it was a sense of confusion that they had about the whole process and what we intended to use the funds for and what the defense of Ross would be. In the trust, Ross was the primary beneficiary and the two sets of grandparents were the contingent beneficiaries. The contingent beneficiaries would then be the people who would receive the trust assets if the primary beneficiary, namely Ross, was not allowed to take the trust assets. In Colorado, there was a law which exists in many states that does not allow the recipient of trust funds who may have been the perpetrator of the deaths of the people who left the trust to receive those funds. Essentially, the law doesn't want the killer to benefit from monies left by the people whom he killed. So to explain that to the parents, I got them an attorney to represent them, told them that under Colorado law, we were going to advance the defense that Ross wasn't responsible for the murders of their children, meaning the grandparents' children, because he suffered from a mental illness and wasn't sane at the time, the accused crime. Once the grandparents understood the dynamics of the defense, and were able to speak with their own attorney, whom I had retained for them, and they eventually agreed that they would consent to the distribution of the trust proceeds to Ross. That gave the probate court the green light to order the trustee to make the distribution without an objection from the grandparents.
You say one of your first tasks was to learn more about your client and the fateful night his parents were killed. And you spoke to Dr. Gregory Willits. Tell us what Dr. Willits had said about his treatment of Ross or his assessment and evaluation of Ross Carlson.
When attorneys in these types of cases decide to advance or are going to consider a mental illness defense or mental capacity defense, one of the aspects of that defense is to see if the individual was undergoing mental health treatment or had a history of mental health treatment. And we were fortunate in this case to learn that for approximately 1 year before the murders of Ross's parents, he had been in treatment with Dr. Willits. The year before these homicides of the parents, Ross was arrested for having posed as an individual who wanted to buy dynamite from a representative of Soldier of Fortune magazine. Undercover officers learned of Ross's intent to buy the dynamite, posed as representatives of that magazine to distribute the dynamite to him, arrested him at the scene, and learned that the reason he wanted to buy the dynamite in part was to blow up the house that he and his parents lived in because he, Ross, believed that he was a burden to his parents. And one way he could alleviate them of their burden, namely him, was for him to die. And he thought by blowing himself up in a house, and that would accomplish that purpose. Ross was placed on probation in that dynamite case with the condition that he undergo psychiatric treatment. And he did that with Dr. Willits. So he, Dr. Willits, was someone whom we wanted to speak to get an idea of what Ross's mental condition and mental health was for the year before the homicides. At the time we met with Dr. Willits, he was anxious and fearful that we might be using that meeting as an opportunity to obtain evidence against him for his failure to make a diagnosis that put the Carlsons in harm's way, namely at the death of their son. So we assured Dr. Willits that that was the last thing that we had in mind. We gave him a release. We would not sue him. And that gave him the green light to discuss Ross's treatment with us in detail. At the time of our discussion, we had some information from investigation that we had done before we met with Dr. Willits, which suggested that Ross thought of himself as being more than one person. We didn't know exactly what that meant. What the investigation showed was that Ross would mention to friends that he, Ross, had a twin brother who lived in Arizona whose name was Justin. We knew that Ross was an only child, so we didn't know what Ross's reference to Justin meant. But as we met with Dr. Willits and began discussing with him some of the investigation that we had done, including the mention of this other individual named Justin, a light bulb went off in Dr. Willits' mind. He slammed his fist on the conference table around which he sat and said to the words to the effect, "Son of a bee, I missed it. This guy may have suffered from multiple personality disorder." And that provoked a very lengthy discussion then during our meeting with Dr. Willits as to exactly what he was talking about. And the more he discussed multiple personality disorder, which he abbreviated as MPD, the more we referred to investigation that we had done, which seemed to be consistent with some of the features, the illness that Dr. Willits was discussing with us. That was the first time that we had heard about this potential diagnosis, which obviously would form the basis of a defense of ours, an eventual plea to the district court of not guilty by reason of insanity.
Now, what was the first thing that you had to do in terms of finding more about this mental illness, but also Ross's background and his parents and the influence of his parents' background on Ross's psychological development?
Obviously, we had two historians, namely his parents, who were deceased and could not provide us with any information about his upbringing. So we had to rely on other sources for that information. That in part included the grandparents, that in part included notes and history that Dr. Willits took about Ross's background, because at the time when Ross was in treatment with Dr. Willits, Ross's parents were still living, and Dr. Willits from time to time would have family psychiatric sessions with them and learn information from them. The key information about the suspected abuse of Ross by his parents and or others would not have been revealed by the parents, of course, because that kind of behavior is typically kept secret from anybody. So we had to go through other sources. They included, but were not limited to, Ross being a historian to Dr. Willits, and also being a historian to experts whom we hired. Actually, Walter hired them to do their forensic evaluation of Ross. It is those doctors with whom we met after we spoke to Dr. Willits to get those doctors' views as to their diagnoses of Ross. One of our doctors diagnosed Ross as having a narcissistic personality and being insane. Another doctor diagnosed Ross as having a mixed personality disorder with features of MPD. A third doctor, who was our psychologist, actually diagnosed Ross as suffering from MPD based upon both clinical diagnosis and testing that the psychologist had done with Ross. It was that psychologist, Dr. Ralph Fish, with whom I relied on for the most part because he was the most knowledgeable of all of our experts regarding the diagnosis. He had made it years before. In a previous case, he had an abundance of literature regarding the diagnosis. He discussed the reasons for his findings with us. And I dove into that information head first with as many pieces of literature and data that I could in order to understand more fully the diagnosis.
You write about the extraordinary meeting you have with Ross and with your partner, Walter. Can you tell us about this experience and tell us about the plan to videotape Ross?
One of the aspects of our defense was to review all the discovery material that the police had amassed regarding Ross and the case against him. So Walter and I, after we had spoken to our experts, including this Dr. Fish, went to the police department to review all the material. There was a smoking gun piece of evidence, which was a black suitcase filled with various personal items, including driver's license of his mother, of his father, of Ross, a 38 caliber Rossi pistol, bullets for the weapon, all the kinds of things that would tie an individual to the murder were in that suitcase. The weapon and the bullets found in the suitcase matched the bullets uncovered from the Carlson decedents during their autopsy. So after that review of evidence, which was at the police station where Ross was detained in jail, Walter and I went back to the jail to talk to Ross to let him know about the results of our interviews with our experts, as well as the evidence that we saw amassed by the police. And Ross began discussing aspects of his mental state. And he began discussing other parts of him and included names that he discussed with us and revealed as Steve, Justin, and other personalities whom Dr. Fish had told us about, but whom Ross never had revealed himself to us. So the first time that Ross was providing us with confirmatory information to some degree of his illness, I took out a piece of paper and I said to him, "Do you have an idea of how many different parts of you or personalities exist?" And he said, "Yeah, I believe I do. I believe there are 9 different personalities." And I said, "Can you write on this sheet of paper what the names of them are?" And he drew a diagram which had 3 levels of names on it. There was the first level, Justin, Steve. There was a next level of Blue, Ray, Michael, Stacy. There was a next level of Norman and Black. And Ross described these levels of personalities as Ross, Justin, and Steve as being the capable personalities or aspects of the sum of his parts. Ray and Blue were the incapable parts of his persona, and Norman and Black were what Ross described as the Antichrist, or the bad persons of the sum of his parts. So he constructed this diagram, described these various personalities. A half hour or 40 minutes went by. I put the diagram in my suitcase. And before Walter and I left the jail, I said, "By the way, Ross, just for my own purposes, I'm going to give you a second piece of paper. Can you again write the construct of personalities that you had written to me before?" He said, "Sure." And he did it in exactly the same way as he had drawn before. As we left the jail, my mentor looked at me with some look of disagreement and said, "I know what you did, David." He said, "The client may think that you didn't trust him by asking him to rewrite that configuration." And I said, "Walter, I needed for my own purposes to believe that what he was telling us was credible. And now I'm convinced that it is."
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Now, you have a doctor asking Ross questions, but a little bit to your surprise, he is asking Ross if there's other characters that will emerge. Tell us about this incredible experience that you witnessed.
After Walter and I had that meeting with Ross at the jail, and these different names of these personalities were disclosed to us, as well as their features. And as we learned more information about how these personalities manifest themselves from the jailers who observed Ross's behavior, it dawned on us, meaning me and Walter, that we had to find a way to present this disorder to a jury who would be seated and judging whether or not Ross was insane at the time of the crime. So it dawned on me that the best way to do that was to videotape a conversation between Ross and our doctors to see if these personalities would emerge during the interview process. If they did, then we'd make a decision about whether or not to show them to a jury. If they didn't emerge, we didn't have to disclose to anyone that we had conducted this interview. So there was no foul, no harm done if nothing positive emerged.
Right.
So we had a session in jail where we had one of our doctors, Robert Fairburn, in whom Ross established a great rapport, sitting with Ross to interview him with a videographer there, with me and Walter sitting in the room, along with Dr. Fairburn and Ross. Ross had been alerted by Dr. Fairburn what the purpose of the interview would be, and he, Dr. Fairburn, began asking Ross questions, some of which were, to whom am I speaking? And Ross initially announced, you're talking to Justin. Now, that's the first time I ever heard Ross respond in that fashion by saying in response to a question. So instead of responding to Dr. Fairburn that you are talking to Ross, the client said, you're talking to Justin. Dr. Fairburn then asked Justin to discuss what Justin's features were as a 16-year-old social butterfly, bon vivant, someone who handles all the social aspects of the various personalities. As the interview progressed, Ross then switched from Justin to a personality called Steve, who described what his features were, namely a 42-year-old who took care of the intellectual aspects, what the sum of the parts were all about. After Steve was talking to Dr. Fairburn, eventually, another personality, Norman, emerged. Norman was a street punk, someone who talked like a hoodlum on the street, someone whom you might see from a gangbanger or what have you. And Norman was a foul-mouthed, cigarette-smoking, rough-talking kind of a guy, and the only one of the personalities who actually smoked. The other personalities, Ross, Steve, Justin, and Norman was the only personality who smoked. The other ones did not. And the way some of the other personalities knew that Norman had been what we called out, close quote, namely, he was the one doing the acting, was when another personality such as Steve or Justin may have felt or tasted a cigarette taste in his mouth. So if Justin all of a sudden emerged after Norman, and when Norman was out, Norman was smoking, Justin would say, I think Norman was out. And he'd be asked, how did you know that? And he would say, because I feel I taste cigarette smoke. Also emerging during that session with Dr. Fairburn was a weeping 6-year-old who didn't talk. He just sat there and cowered and cried. And it was incredible to sit in the same room as this client, whom I had only known as Ross, and seeing him all of a sudden cower and begin crying inconsolably. The last personality who emerged during that session with Dr. Fairburn was Black. Black was the demonic, ruthless protector of all the personalities and would be able to defend against any attack, be it an assault or otherwise, against any of the other personalities and protect them and fend off the attacker by his might. And Black emerged during that session with Dr. Fairburn by ripping away restraints that Dr. Fairburn had tied on Ross's arms and feet, knowing that he, Dr. Fairburn, was going to try to get Black to emerge. And he, Dr. Fairburn, wanted some protection with these restraints if Black, in fact, emerged. With the restraints on, Black eventually emerged and freed himself with his might from these restraints. After that, another personality emerged from Black's presence and realized that Black had been out because that new personality had a metallic taste in his mouth. And that meant to the personality, who I believe was Steve, that Black had emerged.
You talk about the characteristics of multiple personality disorder. What I'm talking about is the hypnotizability and also the aspect of amnesia between personalities. Can you explain how the doctor explained how he went from one personality to another? But also, what did you witness yourself in that transformation from one personality to the other? What did you witness Ross do?
The nature of the illness is that the individual, in order to protect himself from external stress, danger, unpredictability, or other events, will switch from one personality to the other for the purpose of adapting to the environmental or internal stressful situation that has occurred. For example, the illness usually begins developing at an early age. It develops usually from repeated acts of abuse, and often from repeated acts of sexual abuse, and often from other kinds of horrific kinds of abuse. Oftentimes, the perpetrator is a caregiver or someone whose responsibility is to care and love for that child. So as the recipient of the abuse, in the anger and sadness that befalls that individual, what happens is that the child psychologically, to avoid experiencing the continual pain of anger and sadness from the abuse, develops another side of him, which is a happy side. It's a happy side because he doesn't want the caregiver to know that he, the child, is suffering and is angry. And the only way the good and the bad side can coexist is if both sides or either side does not know what has happened to the other. So psychologically, the brain develops a wall of amnesia between the happy, between the two different parts of the individual. And that phenomenon, that psychological phenomenon where the wall of amnesia is constructed, happens with each successive ego state might be formed within the individual. Now, the way that I see them, or the way that I saw them, was after a while, we learned that the way these different ego states or personalities emerged or came out was that Ross would suddenly pause, and he would stare, and his eyes would spasmodically rotate back and forth. And all of a sudden, while his eyes were rotating spasmodically for maybe 15 seconds or so, a new personality would emerge. So, for example, let's say Justin is out and he's talking to me, and it becomes apparent to Justin that I need to talk to someone who understands what's happening in courtroom and can talk intelligently about proceedings that are occurring in court. All of a sudden, Justin will stop talking. He'll pause. He'll stare. His eyes will rotate spasmodically back and forth. And then Steve will emerge and he will say, "Hi, David." And I would say, "Steve?" And he would say, "Yeah." And that would happen frequently. And it would be the clue to me that Ross was about to switch. It was the kind of dynamic that appeared on these videotape sessions that our doctors did of Ross, including the one that I just previously talked about regarding Dr. Fairburn.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear from our sponsor. Ladies, here is some interesting health information. There was a federal law where women were excluded from clinical research policy until 1993. Ritual conducted a university-led clinical trial for their Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin to assess its efficacy. The results were vitamin D levels increased by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in just 12 weeks. My wife Lisa started with Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus just based on the research that Ritual had undertaken to develop their multivitamin. It's been a few years now for her and almost as many for me, and we both continue to rely on Ritual multivitamin every day. This multivitamin is made with high quality and traceable key nutrients in clean, bioavailable forms. With 9 key nutrients and 2 capsules per day, their unique bed latan oil capsule technology is even patented. Essential for Women 18 Plus is one of the few women's multis that's USP verified, meaning what's on the label is what's in the formula. It's also soy-free, gluten-free, vegan-friendly, and formulated without GMOs. Ritual is all about hot data and stone-cold facts. Get to know your nutrients on a deeper level with 20% off during your first month. Visit ritual.com/murder to start Ritual or add Essential for Women 18 Plus to your subscription today. Now, you believe that you have to get a nationally known expert to win the sanity case, and you believe that the priority for your team is to address this upcoming sanity trial after a competency trial. But you were told something by Dr. Wilbur, I believe, about the importance of the competency trial before the insanity trial. So could you explain that?
Sure. One of the questions I asked Dr. Fairbairn after he had this session with Ross was seeing that Ross switched from one personality to another and that he wasn't able to remember, that one personality wasn't able to remember all of what another personality may have known. I asked Dr. Fairbairn about the issue of competency, namely, well, based upon what we've just seen in your videotape session with Ross, Dr. Fairbairn, is the client competent to proceed? Because it's unpredictable in terms of how often he will switch and whether he will have, and whether the new personality will have any memory of just what happened in court. And Dr. Fairbairn eventually answered the question by saying, I agree, he is not competent, and you should file a motion to determine that he is incompetent. By then, we already had a sanity trial, I believe, set for sometime in June of 1984. We filed our motion to declare Ross was incompetent, but we weren't confident that that motion for competency would prevail because, frankly, we didn't know enough about how important a determination of competency was. Plus, we believed that we needed to prepare more for the sanity case than the competency case, even though the competency motion was being heard first. So during a session with our doctors, we all agreed that we needed to probably find some national expert to help us address the issue of sanity and to advance the notion of MPD. So I called Cornelia Wilbur, who was famous for having diagnosed the famous character that she wrote about and which a movie was written about called Sybil. And I called her Dr. Wilbur. She was a professor emeritus in Kentucky. I introduced myself, told her what I was looking for, namely an expert in MPD to testify on our behalf at the sanity trial. And because she had a conflict and an illness, she couldn't come, but she referred me to other experts in the field of MPD, which eventually led me to what experts referred to as the foremost expert in the world on MPD, a clinical and forensic psychologist in Santa Monica, California, called Bernauer Newton, also known affectionately as Fig Newton. I called Dr. Newton 3 days before the competency hearing was to begin, but a few weeks before the sanity trial was to begin, with the objective of seeing if he would agree to be our witness at the sanity trial. And he was emphatic by saying, well, wouldn't you want me for the competency hearing? Because the competency hearing is probably just as important, if not more important, than the sanity hearing. And he explained that if Ross were deemed incompetent, that the hospital or other treatment providers would be required to treat him and to eventually successfully treat him, which would be to fuse or merge all the personalities into one whole. And by that treatment process, all the incidents of abuse would be uncovered by the individual personalities who were abused by their perpetrator. If we hadn't succeeded in that kind of treatment process, we were not going to be able to uncover the full body and ocean of abusive acts that would have been committed against Ross, because they would have been encased in secretive parts of Ross's ego, only to be uncovered with extensive and expert treatment. And since that hadn't occurred, we didn't have the full body of abusive behavior that we believe we needed to deem the illness of MPD credible in the face of a fact finder. So when Dr. Newton told us about the importance of the competency hearing, and to my surprise, said he could hop on a plane that night and come to Colorado, evaluate Ross, and be ready to testify at the competency hearing, we accepted the invitation. And long story short, Dr. Newton came here with his own video equipment, interviewed Ross, concluded that Ross was definitely suffering from MPD, and was one of our star witnesses at the competency hearing.
At the competency hearing, can you tell us about the outcome and then this treatment that you expected and you and Walter had expected for Ross to be able to get at this Colorado State Hospital?
At the competency hearing, the burden was on us to show Ross was incompetent. And that finding would be that as a result of his mental illness, he was unable to assist us in our defense and was unable to cooperate with us in our defense, in large measure because the nature of his illness was such that he switched constantly and didn't have continual memory or continuity of memory. Plus, because of his illness, we weren't able to discover the incidents of abuse. And all of that rendered Ross incompetent because he was incapable of assisting us and uncovering that information and making him whole to the point where he had continuity of memory. So we presented evidence to show aberrant behavior of Ross's before the homicides. And for that, we used friends of Ross's who talked about his unusual behavior before the homicides or consistent with the personalities of Justin, Stephen, and Norman. We had our expert witnesses who had diagnosed Ross with MPD testify to their conclusions. We had them talk about the information they uncovered in their videotape interviews of Ross. We had Dr. Newton testify as our last key expert. And then we cross-examined vigorously the experts for the prosecution, who concluded, among other things, that Ross did not suffer from MPD, that if anything, he was a malingerer and faker, that he suffered perhaps from mixed personality disorder, but not MPD. And after the prosecution's witnesses concluded, Walter and I knew that we had an ace in the hole, another lay witness whom we decided we would save for the end and rebuttal if we deemed it necessary to call him. And this was an individual who was the son of a couple who lived in the Carlson's neighborhood, who employed Ross when he was aged 15 or so to cut their lawn. And we're talking now in the competency hearing of Ross, of the client, being 19 years old. And we're talking about a witness who was talking about Ross's behavior when Ross was 15 years old. And the behavior was that Ross knocked on the door of the neighbor's home and yelled and protested to the young man that someone, not Ross, but that someone else had cut the lawn. And the young man said, Ross, you cut the lawn. And Ross said, I didn't cut the lawn. The kid said, yeah, you cut the lawn. And Ross accused the family of trying to beat him out of the fee that he was entitled to for cutting the lawn. That was dramatic evidence that two different personalities had been present at this neighborhood home, one of whom cut the lawn, the second of whom protested that and accused the neighbors of cutting the lawn themselves and not knowing that another personality had done it. That evidence was, along with our expert testimony, evidence of pre-homicidal instances, evidence from me and Walter, who also testified at the competency hearing and testified the difficulties we had in representing Ross because of his inability to cooperate and his frequent switching, persuaded the trial judge to conclude that Ross suffered from MPD and was incompetent and would have to be then housed at the state hospital and there treated until restored to competency, which would be the successful treatment and fusion of his personalities. At the order, although something that we wanted, in reality turned out to be a nightmare because of the failures and excuses and neglect and refusals by the state hospital and their incompetency with respect to the treatment of this illness.
Let's use this opportunity to stop for a second.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
To hear from these messages. Now, you write about the reasoning that they gave. The prosecution is involved as well. And the hospital in denying this order for treatment for Ross Carlson.
We're talking about a period of 5 years or so that Ross was in the custody of the state hospital under orders to treat him and a five-year debacle of their failure to do that. Early on, within days after Ross was declared incompetent in June of 1984, and Ross being then admitted to the state hospital in early July, upon admission, the admissions director of the hospital poo-pooed the court finding, ridiculed the findings made by the judge, ridiculed the defense that Ross, that Walter and I advanced, maligned Walter's lawyering ability, and in a sense, undermined the court order and suggested to Ross that the hospital was not going to treat him. We found out about that exchange early on from Ross. It took copious notes of the exchange between this admissions director and Ross, and we reported this to the hospital people and to the judge. The hospital quickly did an about face, removed that admissions director and any other people who may have had previous contact with Ross from further treatment of him, and appointed their chief psychologist and chief psychiatrist as the lead treatment caregivers for Ross. After their appointment, these individuals, independent of one another, and on the basis of their own clinical diagnosis and findings, as well as testing that the psychologist did, both opined that Ross suffered from MPD and that in order for treatment to be successful, he would have to undergo extensive treatment that might take years to accomplish before his personalities were fused. That was a good sign. It was a promising sign for successful treatment in accordance with the judge's order. Unbeknownst to us, the prosecution directed their principal investigator to go into the Carlson neighborhood in Littleton, Colorado, to go back to where the Carlsons came from in Minnesota and interview people to find out if anyone of the neighbors or people who knew the family saw any evidence of childhood abuse. And the reports came back that none of them had, which was not surprising because child abusers do not abuse kids publicly or in front of others. So those findings in that investigation was not unexpected. Notwithstanding, the prosecutors sent the body of that investigative information to the state hospital, to the chief psychiatrist, to the chief psychologist, who then began questioning Ross as to the history of abuse, which is a question that a skilled clinician would never ask a patient, for the patient to justify how he or she has been abused, by whom and when. With that sophomoric kind of questioning, the report that had been established between Ross and these chief investigators, meaning the chief psychiatrist and chief psychologist, was demolished, destroyed, and Ross abandoned and withdrew from any further contact with these people, and then was left to wallow in the state hospital without treatment.
There is one bright spot, and before we get to talking about this tragic conclusion to this, but there was one bright spot. Former girlfriend, name has changed, but Kelly Olson comes back into his life, gets his phone number from a friend of Ross, and then calls him, and then eventually makes the trip to the Colorado State Hospital to visit with him.
You properly informed your readership or listening group that the woman's name, as I describe her in my book, is Kelly Olson, which is not her real name. I purposely avoided disclosing the real name of this girlfriend because she is someone who, when Ross was 18 years old, dated when this young girl was 14 years old. They became lovers during the year or so that they dated. And a month or so before the homicides, this young girl had to move to Arizona with her family because her father's job required a transfer of him to Arizona. When Ross was arrested and accused of this crime, and this young woman found out what had happened to him, and eventually that in 1984, he was found incompetent. By then, she had reached the age of 17, 18 years of age and wanted to visit him at the state hospital. We agreed to that visit. Ross wanted to see her. The two visited sometime in 1985 or so. They rekindled their relationship and continued having an ongoing correspondence between the two while she was in Arizona and he was at the state hospital, keeping me in the loop about their continual communication. And they continued to do that throughout Ross's hospitalization, and she would from time to time come back to Colorado to visit with him while he was at the hospital. And there was one time in particular when he was having a bad time at the state hospital and was switching from one personnel to the next. We were in court having a hearing. Ross, me, and Walter, spectators, as often occurred, were seated in the courtroom, and one of whom was this former girlfriend. Ross looked back into the spectator section to see who was there. He looked at me and said, "There's a young woman looking at me. I don't know who she is. Can you tell me who she is?" I told him who she was. After the court hearing was over, I informed Kelly, what I call her in the book, that she had to forgive Ross because he was having a difficult time adjusting and going in and out from one personnel to another, that he didn't recognize her and wasn't going to meet with her. And she was devastated by it.
You find a person named Quinn, Dr. Quinn, and he's been treating someone named Dupree with multiple personality disorder. And you thought he might be the person to treat Ross while he was in the hospital. And as of courts, you got Dr. Quinn to be the person to be able to treat him. What happened with that treatment order?
After Dr. Quinn was given the go-ahead by our judge to treat Ross, the question was, who is going to pay for the treatment? And it was our belief that because it was the hospital's burden and responsibility to treat Ross, that the financial obligation should be theirs. Dr. Quinn agreed, Walter and I agreed, and we presented the motion to our competency judge, the one who found Ross incompetent and was still our judge, our retired Supreme Court Justice Edward Day. And Judge Day agreed that it was the hospital's responsibility to pay for Ross's treatment. The hospital balked at that. They appealed Judge Day's order to the Colorado Supreme Court. After several months of the matter pending before it, the Supreme Court reversed Judge Day and said sufficient findings of the hospital's inadequacy and negligence in treatment hadn't been established on the record, and therefore the hospital was relieved of the obligation at this juncture to pay for Ross's treatment. But Dr. Quinn never got the opportunity to pursue the court order of treating Ross. The hospital prevailed in establishing a roadblock to that treatment.
Now, through this, you continue this fight, advocate for your client, Ross Carlson, but then you get a call about his health from the hospital one day. Tell us what that call, what information you get from that call.
I got a call from a psychiatrist who I believe was Dawn McNeese. And she said, Mr. Carlson has been observed in the cafeteria and it appears that he has become incontinent, that he has soiled his pants and is unaware of how it occurred. And we believe he should be investigated for some kind of brain injury or brain tumor. I knew when this event occurred, which was the day of Ross's birthday. I said, Dr. McNeese, I don't want to quibble with your diagnosis because you're the doctor, I'm not, but I think there may have been a psychological dynamic for what he did, because he does not like his birthday, because he does not believe his birth was a positive event in his life. Nevertheless, she said, well, I think he needs to be examined for a possible brain tumor. And would you agree to an order to have him sent to a hospital in Denver? Because the state hospital was located a few hours from Denver in the city called Pueblo. And I said, sure. So Ross was transferred to Denver Health, examined there, and not surprisingly, it was determined that he did not suffer any kind of brain tumor, other brain invasion or problem, and that the event of his incontinence was probably psychologically based.
Tell us about the diagnosis of leukemia.
At some point in time, a different judge was appointed to oversee the competency aspect of Ross's case because the prosecution succeeded in having the previous judge, Judge Day, recuse himself or withdraw from further involvement in the case on an unfounded accusation of bias. Judge Day voluntarily agreed to drop out of the case, and a successor judge was appointed, Judge Kingsley. At another competency hearing in September of 1987, Judge Kingsley again found Ross incompetent. Another competency hearing was held in November of 1989, by which time Ross had created another personality to make it appear as if he were competent, because he wanted to get the HEP out of the state hospital. And he knew the only way he could do that was to make it appear he was competent. So at a hearing in November of 1989, Judge Kingsley found Ross to be competent, which meant that Ross would now face a trial regarding whether or not he was insane at the time the crime was committed. By virtue of the finding of competency by Judge Kingsley, Ross was then released from the state hospital and returned to the jail in Douglas County, where he was originally housed after his arrest. We, meaning Ross, me, and Walter, appeared before the trial judge, who would then be in charge of the sanity case. We got a new date for the sanity trial. After the sanity trial, we met with Ross in the jail, and he complained of a nosebleed. And he said he never had had this kind of physical event before and didn't know what it was all about, but suspected it may have been because he felt he had a cold and chilled and what have you. So we thought nothing of it, and we left. A few days later, I received a phone call early in the morning, 1 or 2 in the morning, from the jailers who said that Ross was rushed to a local hospital in Castle Rock because of his chronic nosebleeds, that doctor recommended that Ross be immediately transferred to a more comprehensive hospital for a more comprehensive exam, because he, the doctor, feared that Ross might be suffering from leukemia. Ross was transferred to a hospital not too far from Denver in a city called Littleton, where a specialist in blood work, a hematologist, an oncologist, conducted some tests and made a preliminary diagnosis that Ross suffered from leukemia, and the call that I got at 2 o'clock in the morning from a sheriff provided that history to me that I just described to you, and further asking that I come to the hospital in Littleton as soon as possible, because Ross was refusing treatment for the suspected leukemia unless I was there and approved of the treatment. I got in my car, rushed to the hospital, met with the treating oncologist, hematologist, who provided me with the preliminary diagnosis. I met with Ross and persuaded him to undergo some of the tests to enable the doctor to make a more specific diagnosis. That was made, and Ross was eventually transferred from that hospital in Littleton to a more expert facility in the Denver area called the University of Colorado Health Hospital, where he there treated for his leukemia.
You had to say goodbye to Ross, didn't you?
I'm going to measure my words for any number of reasons, including an agreement I have with my publisher about describing the end of this case. Mm. So I will say yes, I did. Was able to spend time with Ross and get him through aspects of his treatment.
I want to just thank you, David B. Savitz, for coming on and talking about Just in the Nick of Time. For people that want to find out more about this case, is there a website they might refer to?
Yes, and thanks for asking, Dan. It's www.rosscarlsontrial.com. Those three words are run together.com.
I want to thank you very much, David B. Savitz, for coming on and talking about your book, Just in the Nick of Time. Thank you very much for this interview, and you have a great evening.
Thanks for having me, and likewise to you, Dan.
Thank you, and good night.
Good night.